You're listening to the Health and Happiness program on Radio 95.9 FM or KGVM.org on the internet. We're happy to be associated with the Montana Psychological Association Public Education Committee, who gives us their professional support. We emphasize anything that may be healthy or happy, with an emphasis on matters of mental health. I am Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. She now introduces today's program.
Okay, imagine you are a young reporter not long after you graduate, and you take a job in Montana and end up on the national news with a herd of buffalo. Today's guest began his career in just that way. Please welcome Dion Broxton, star reporter and journalist, to tell us that story one more time. Could you do that, Dion?
Yeah, I can tell it for the 1 millionth time. So that video happened during the start of the pandemic. And I remember that I've been to Yellowstone probably 24 times while I was in Montana. And it's the drive is 1 hour and 15 minutes from Bozeman to Yellowstone, Gardner, Montana. And Mammoth Hot Springs is the north entrance for Yellowstone. And after going several dozen times, you know, you get kind of tired of making that drive. So I remember the news director telling me to go to Yellowstone to report on the park closing down for COVID. And I was just so upset because I just did not feel like doing it. And I remember on my way to the park, I couldn't even interview the superintendent and because of COVID. So I had to pull over on the side of the road and do a phone interview with the superintendent. But, you know, I still had to go to get B-roll and footage of the park looking empty because no one could enter because of the pandemic. And I remember when I arrived in Gardner at not too far from Mammoth Hot Springs, I remember just seeing all the bison and thinking to myself, like, wow, these animals are really kind of reclaiming their territory with no humans around. But by that time, I've been to the north entrance so many times, I just thought, you know, I'm used to these animals by this point. As long as I keep my distance, don't bother them, they won't bother me. And as you see in the video, I was at a comfortable distance, but I believe it was like 5 or 6 of them. And they were like slowly like walking towards me. I don't think I was the intended target, but I was just in their path. And as you can see in the video, they got too close for comfort for my liking. And I threw my camera and my tripod in the trunk and I pulled off. But I got to a safe space to finish recording what I wanted to record. And then I filmed the animals as well. Not thinking that the video would go viral, I was just thinking, like, let me just get B-roll to show people that there are no humans here and there are just animals everywhere. And I still remember it like it was yesterday. Within seconds, minutes of posting the video on Twitter, like, my phone would not stop buzzing. I remember CNN was the first news outlet to call the news station to ask if they could use the video. And then for the next 3 days, it was just madness. If I recall correctly, I think it happened on a Wednesday. And Wednesday, my phone wouldn't stop buzzing. Thursday, my phone wouldn't stop buzzing. And I had to call my news director on Friday morning. And I told him that I couldn't work because my phone just won't stop buzzing. I mean, yeah, I could mute my notifications, but people were still calling, asking for interviews. So I literally dedicated that whole Friday to giving people interviews. And it wasn't because I wanted to be famous or anything. I know what it's like to be a journalist, wanting someone to do an interview and hoping to get this person. So I wanted to return the favor and have good karma by helping out other journalists.
What was your famous phrase?
If I recall, you were setting up your camera outside your car with the door open, and you looked up and they were coming toward you, and you said, I know what you said, I remember.
Let's hear it.
I'm not messing with you.
Not messing with you guys, yeah.
And the National Park Service actually made a, I guess it's like a, it's not a plaque, it's like a sign, something like maybe like a stop sign. I mean, it's not a stop sign, but it's like the same material that you would use for a street sign. Mm-hmm. And they made something like that for me that says National Park Service, I'm not messing with you, with the silhouette of a buffalo. A picture of it is on my Instagram page.
Oh, it should be forever. Oh, my goodness. That was terrific. Oh, everybody fell in love with that story. And moving on to another aspect, we've been doing a series on journalism, and we dislike having to report via World Press Freedom Index that in 2025, the condition for journalism is poor in half the world's countries. And we tend to be having great difficulties taking care of our journalists these days. And there's also a lot of political change occurring. So, Dion, where are you on how journalists are faring currently?
This is actually a question that I was asked by from journalists in Austria. I was recently on a fellowship for media professionals and journalists. And to give you a description, I kind of saw where the industry, well, I knew where the industry is heading. It's already a tough industry. The pay isn't great. I saw some of the turmoil that existed under the first Trump presidency, because I was in Bozeman from 2018 to 2020, and that was during Trump's first term. And I covered several Trump rallies in Montana. And I don't want to sensationalize it. The people weren't mean to the media, but I remember during a during Trump's speech, he said, you know, fake news. And I remember people in the crowd, like, giving us the finger and booing us. And that was just something that I wasn't accustomed to as a journalist. But to go back to Austria, this question was asked of me. And I think it is harder right now to, one, take care of journalists, and two, to be a journalist. You know, we have to be out and about in order to perform our job. And we don't always have, you know, people with us. I mean, if you're a newspaper reporter or a radio reporter, 9 times out of 10, you might be alone, versus a TV reporter. If you're a multimedia journalist, you could be alone as well. But sometimes you have a photographer there with you for safety. But, you know, I've seen incidences of reporters being attacked and being annoyed and being heckled for just doing their job. And I think that we're in an environment right now where the president incites that kind of behavior towards journalists. So on top of it being a difficult job, on top of it being receiving low pay, and then to have the rhetoric that's going around right now, I think it's just, it spells disaster. And you see a lot of people leaving the industry. And I mean, you all watch the news, and I'm sure you've seen, you know, newspaper reporters and radio reporters. It's a young person's game right now. You don't see the older people in the profession anymore. One, because the money isn't that great, but two, you know, you want to get home to your family. You don't want to be heckled and have someone possibly target you and jeopardize the safety of your family. Because, I mean, frankly, we're just in an environment where you see people like Charlie Kirk be assassinated. We see the lawmakers who were in Minnesota who were assassinated. Some journalists feel that a journalist could be next. So it's a very tough industry right now. And I think, you know, social media doesn't help, But if we had politicians who were willing to not try to have a sexy soundbite that goes viral online, we would be in a much better environment. And I think the tenacity we've seen between politicians, this spreads to journalists who are just trying to cover the tenacity that we're seeing.
Absolutely. I think from the Montana Free Press, they reflected that although physical attacks against journalists are the most visible violations of press freedom, economic pressure is also a major, more insidious problem. The economic indicator on the RSF World Press Freedom Index now stands at an unprecedented critical low as its decline continued in 2025. And as a result, the global state of press freedom is now classified as a difficult situation for the first time in the history of the index. And they state further that without economic independence, there can be no free press.
And we see that with CBS and ABC. CBS, I think, paid the federal government, the Trump administration, I think it was $15 or $16 million for the way 60 Minutes, I believe, edited a Kamala Harris video. And now we're seeing that someone who's a Trump ally is now like overseeing like Paramount or one of the companies that's overseeing CBS, and people feel like you just can't have that independence now because you don't want to anger your bosses who may not agree with the way you're telling the story. And we saw ABC was sued because George Stephanopoulos reported wrong information. And that, I mean, I think it's safe to say that, you know, journalists aren't looking to report wrong information. But like ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, you know, these have been trusted pillars of journalism for a long time, where I think there are, you know, other news outlets out there who cherry pick data and present a certain narrative to its viewers for the sake of making money. And I think we've always frowned upon that. But now it's like we're seeing these more traditional media outlets having to capitulate to the Trump administration because they don't want to, one, lose money, but two, the goal is, if you're a for-profit news outlet, the goal is to make money. And at the end of the day, if you want to be able to hire journalists and not fire people, I think at some point you have to capitulate, unless you're like PBS. Well, we see even PBS now and NPR. They're losing federal funding, so these are questions they have to face as well, on top of their journalists who they want to pay more money, but they can't, because we know that historically for-profit journalism has relied on advertising, but now with social media taking a big chunk of the advertising and streaming services and so many ways now to consume ads, it's that pot for traditional journalism is just dwindling. And I think the industry is really starting to lose credibility with, you know, like, no offense, but I think if you're for someone who believes in transparency with the government, you will want a seasoned journalist to be reporting in your neighborhood. You may not necessarily want someone fresh out of high school. I mean, yeah, like someone fresh out of, I mean, college. Yeah, someone fresh out of college could do a good job, but I think there's a trust there when you know that the journalist in your neighborhood has been doing it at least for a decade or so.
Yeah. We see this trend, and I think it's quite worrisome to any American concerned about freedom of the press. And in the United States, where the economic indicator has dropped by more than 14 points in 2 years for news efforts, vast regions are turning into news deserts. Local journalism is bearing the brunt of the economic turndown. And over 60% of journalists and media experts agree that it's difficult to earn a living wage as a journalist, and 75% believe that the average media outlet struggles for economic viability. And so our country's drop to the 28th place in social indicators reveals that the press operates in an increasingly hostile environment.
Mm-hmm. And Bozeman is an example of that. When I was in Bozeman, Sinclair Broadcast Group, which is based in the Baltimore area, they own Bozeman. They own stations in Bozeman, Butte, Kalispell, and Missoula. And at the time, we had we were broadcasting out of I'll say like a main station. We had two main stations, one in Missoula and then one in Bozeman. And then Bozeman, we had our own newscast, and then Missoula had its own newscast, while Kalispell and Butte were bureaus that journalists would produce videos and still report live for the Bozeman station or for the Missoula station. But it gave the viewers in those areas some options, right? And you weren't relying on just one source. Now that Bozeman station is no longer a station that broadcasts that's now it all comes out of Missoula now, and that Bozeman station became a bureau. And I think that hurts the individuals who live in these areas, because when I worked for the Bozeman station, you had two reporters, two anchors, and one sports person. Now, if I'm not mistaken, that Bozeman station might only have just one reporter, one news reporter, and one sports reporter. Because when you don't have to have anchors anymore, that's less people you have to pay. And I think you suffer because of that. And I knew how helpful it was for me as a journalist to have two veteran anchors on the desk to teach me how to tell a story. Now you have maybe one or two reporters in Bozeman who have to make a phone call to a boss in Missoula to get guidance. And that not only hurts the reporter, that hurts the people who are consuming the news. And one, there's already a distrust of the media, but then when you're seeing someone not maybe reporting news accurately or answering those questions you want to have answered, then that's when the trust further is eroded with the public. Like, one thing that was big that I learned in my time in Bozeman, people want to know how much of their tax money is being spent on stuff. So to give you an example, for me, I might say the Bozeman Fire Department have three new trucks now. The fire chief says that these trucks will help out when there are multiple fires happening. And that's a good story. But the taxpayer wants to know, how much of my money did you spend on these three trucks? And those were questions I didn't really think about as a young journalist, where when you have an anchor or someone who's a veteran can help guide you to remind you, hey, always ask how much of taxpayers' money is being spent on public goods. And, you know, I don't know if those quality stories are still being told right now in Bozeman.
And that's worrisome. And we see that same thing in Washington. From CNN, the White House is stripping the White House Correspondents Association of its role in managing the White House press pool, taking control of deciding who will be a part of the small rotating group of journalists and photographers who accompany the president. This group, the White House Correspondents Association, has evenly balanced who could be in at any given time as reporters and made sure that all different groups were represented, and they've done a really good job since the 1950s. And so now, moving forward, according to Leavitt, the White House press secretary, the White House press pool will be determined by the White House press corps.
And, you know, people are criticized for comparing this administration to Nazi Germany. I did a fellowship in Germany last year. I spent a week in Berlin and a week in Poland, and we visited Auschwitz. And there was a curriculum for us that we studied while in those 2 weeks there. And, you know, being a journalist, a full-time journalist at the time, a year ago, you know, my discipline or my cohort was made up of journalists. And we learned about how the Nazi Party silenced journalists and news outlets that they didn't agree with. And they would promote the ones who they did agree with or who were willing to share and spread that propaganda. And I think, and I don't think, I know, we all know this, that's what's happening now. The Trump administration wants news outlets that will portray it in a positive light. That's why you see, you know, Newsmax, and I believe it was the Department of Defense maybe a week or two ago, where they wanted like journalists to sound like an oath. And like even like Fox News refused to sign this oath. And then some far right news outlet was willing to sign this oath. So, I mean, like, it's always good to be challenged, even regardless if you're a Democrat or Republican. It's always good to be challenged and for the government to answer those challenging questions, because I think it builds faith in the public to know that my government, the person who's leading my country, who's leading my city, who's leading my state, isn't afraid to address the elephant in the room and has a plan to address these challenges. And I think the Trump administration would lose faith in the public by not being willing to answer these tough questions. And when I say answer these questions, you give a detailed response, not something that you will insult the intelligence of the person listening to your response.
Exactly. In another article, I noted that longtime White House correspondents expressed deep alarm at the changes happening. One said, having served as a Moscow correspondent in the early days of Putin's reign, this reminds me of how the Kremlin took over its own press pool and made sure that only compliant journalists were given access. New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker wrote on X, every president of both parties going back generations subscribed to the principle that a president doesn't pick the press corps that is allowed to ask him questions. Well, Trump has just declared that he will.
Yeah, and I do think there is blowback from what we're seeing. This was a question also asked by the Austrians while I was there a couple mm-hmm. of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how are Americans reacting to this? Obviously, Democrats don't agree with this. But I think that it's what's more important to focus on right now are the Republicans. Because in Missouri, where I live, you're seeing Republican candidates hold these town halls, and you're seeing their Republican constituents saying, like, why won't you stand up to Trump? Why are you allowing him to do this? So if they want to if the Trump administration wants to continue to do this, I'll say this. The Republicans who support Trump really have to figure out how to navigate this with their constituents, because I don't think their constituents are, not all of, some of them obviously are still on board, but some aren't. Like with the SNAP benefits, for example, they want to know, what is our president doing to help negotiate with Republicans and Democrats? And certain Republicans have to weigh, do I want to run again next year, because it's hard for me to look my constituents in my face and tell them what is going on is good right now. I think of, you know, I reported in Iowa a couple of years ago. Joni Ernst seemed to be happy being a senator for Iowa. Now she announced that she's not running again for Senate. And, you know, I have to ask myself, I want to ask her, is this because you just can't go along with the Trump train anymore? So with Trump, he's already on his second term. So he's not trying to, in my opinion, sway Republican voters anymore, because he can't run again. And so there's nothing for him to lose versus Republicans who want to be reelected. They have to look themselves in the mirror and say, like, how do I navigate this and get my constituents to vote for me again? Because Democrats aren't the only one who are upset right now. Republicans are upset as well.
Yeah, we had about 7,000 people downtown Bozeman Saturday a couple of weeks back, and it was impressive and peaceful and kind and caring and really addressing the current situation that you're bespeaking here. And I wonder if this doesn't bring up the concept that news persons deal with of disinformation. So why would you want to take over the press corps? Why would you not want all reporters to be able to speak freely? What do you think's happening? What is the plan? What is the reasoning there, Dion, that you see would prompt that?
Well, I think it's that's a very loaded question that I'm going to try to answer quickly. But I think it's because Democrats outnumber Republicans in this country. And if Republicans want to retain power, they have to decrease the number of Democrats in this country. I think that's why we see ICE, the Trump administration being so tough on immigration, not even just illegal immigration, but immigration, period. I don't know if you saw this, but within the last few days, J.D. Vance said that America needs to limit immigration. Now, you can agree or disagree with that, but I think most people would say that if you're pro-immigration, you're most likely a Democrat, you know? And so I think the Trump administration, they're trying to take all the avenues possible to limit the amount of Democrats in this country. So if you can kick out an immigrant who may likely be a Democrat and want his brother and his or her brothers and sisters and family members to come, you can help Republicans have a fair fight when it comes to these elections. I think the same thing is with the media. We're seeing the Republicans blame the Democrats and the Democrats blame Republicans for the shutdown. But it makes sense when the Democrats say, we don't want to have a government shutdown. We want to make sure that people have health care. And the Republicans are just saying that Democrats want health care for illegal immigrants. Illegal immigrants can't get health care. You know, so I think it makes sense to try to fool people by saying things like that, so that way Republicans can have a stronghold in these rural areas. And if you can convince people of this propaganda, then it'll work. I mean, we've seen this with Nazi Germany. We see this with Russia. We see this with a lot of authoritarian countries where propaganda can be really effective. And I think that was the case for the election with Joe Biden and not with Joe Biden, but with Kamala Harris and Trump. You know, I mean, Trump had a simple and effective message. He said that the economy was better under me. If you vote me in again, I'll make sure it gets better. But what was ignored was the Biden administration. The economy was getting better under the Biden administration. Inflation was going down. And since Trump has been back in office, inflation has gone back up. So, like, I mean, these are proven facts. And obviously the Trump administration doesn't want to acknowledge this. This can be vice versa as well, where a Democrat can blame Republicans for a bad economy. But the facts are that the economy was improving under Biden, and then now it's going back downhill under Trump. But in order to combat that narrative, you create propaganda to fool people so they can vote for you again and keep your party in power for years to come if you can fool them. And I think people just aren't being fooled anymore, even the ones who voted for Trump.
Tell me, how is journalism going to deal with AI?
Well, that's a big topic as well. From across all industries, this topic has been crafted this way. you can't use AI as the main, I'm going to say thing because I can't think of a better word right now, but AI can't be the main conduit, if you will, when it comes to creating something. And it needs to be in a support aspect. So I think if, you know, you have small, basic stories with not much information, I think you can tell AI to write a story. You know, like, hey, ChatGPT, the police said X, Y, and Z. Write me an article. And you can, I mean, that's, you can get that done pretty quickly. But when it comes to, like, investigative journalism, AI can never replace something like investigative journalism. So I think we will see AI where that can, you know, maybe schedule out a couple of stories via social media, maybe even write some stories that are pretty basic. But when it comes to, like, real journalism, I think there's still a craving in this country for real investigative journalism. And I don't think AI will get rid of it, but I do think AI will result. And I think this already is resulting in people losing their jobs. And I think the people who have the, who maybe have some safety with their jobs might be an investigative journalist, where you know that someone who's built those contacts and knows how to uncover information and dig deep, that person will provide value to a news organization versus a general assignment reporter, you know, who may just be covering, like, who may receive a press release and just needs to write a story on a press release. You can tell AI to do that. So I think AI will take over the low-hanging fruit, but I don't think it will replace investigative good journalism.
And so back to the concept of all the president's men, you still need a journalist to go in and uncover vital truths. Yeah.
Yeah, I think people crave that. I mean, like, we talk about, let's talk about Doge, for example. Doge has been saying, we've cut all this money, we've saved Americans this much money. Me, as a resident, as a U.S. citizen, I want an investigative journalist to dig deep into the numbers to see if there's any truth to this. And I have seen some of those stories where journalists have said, you know, we've asked Doge to approve this, and they haven't yet. Mm-hmm. So, like, I think there's always going to be a craving for investigative journalism. I mean, like, as a former full-time journalist, now I freelance in my spare time when I get the chance, you know, I get giddy when I see really good investigative journalism. And I think the average person likes that as well.
We couldn't agree more. And we depend on journalists. And back to our earlier thought about immigration, I just wanted to mention, I saw an article yesterday that people across the world are not viewing America as the best last place to come anymore. And immigration is reduced drastically. Also, we had our airport director here at Bozeman on not long ago, and he said that international travel has dropped precipitously under the new rhetoric coming out of the White House and the new politics of anti-immigration.
And this brings up a good point. Is that Brian Springer, the Bozeman director, the airport director?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, I interviewed him a couple of times while I was there. And I told him that Bozeman Airport needed Southwest, because Southwest has direct flights to Baltimore. And I remember a couple of months after leaving Bozeman, the airport got Southwest.
Oh, not fair. That means you need to come back sometime.
Exactly. But to your point about international travel being down, you know, I've been to Germany, three times now in the last 2 years?
But it's fascinating to hear how people across the world are perceiving the political changes occurring in the USA right now.
And they're shocked. And they're just like, how could this have happened? And what I've been, and I didn't know this until I moved away from the East Coast. I've told my European friends, like, the middle of the country is very conservative. And this is not to say, like, in a I'm not trying to be dismissive of conservative views, but I said, like, on the West Coast and on the East Coast, it's pretty progressive. And I said, in the middle of the country, it's pretty conservative. And I didn't really see this until I moved to Iowa. And in my opinion, Montana was pretty, like, I know Montana is conservative, but it wasn't like a jaw-dropping conservative while I was there. What was jaw-dropping conservative was when I was in Iowa, and now I live here in Missouri, where I'm shocked at how conservative these places are. But after living in Iowa and now living here in Missouri for 4 years, I am not shocked that Trump won this election, because Europeans were shocked that after the insurrection that he won. He won again. And I told them, like, and if you go visit Missouri, you go visit these red states, like, they, January 6th is not that big of a deal to them. You know, they're willing to look the other way to vote for him. And some of these voters are single issue voters, where if Trump is going to defend abortion, they will vote for him. And knowing that, I said this, I have a friend who's a journalist in San Francisco. The day that Joe Biden dropped out and he said that Kamala, you know, and they said that Kamala was going to run in his place, he said, "What do you think?" I said, "Trump's going to win." I said, "America isn't ready for a black woman to be president." I wish I was wrong about that, but she even said it herself in her book, where she said that, "I was a black woman running for president. I couldn't pick Pete Buttigieg, a gay man, to be my partner. I don't think America's ready for that," you know? So, like, I knew that she wasn't going to win, because the first time she ran, I think she polled less than 1%. So I just knew that. I knew, especially with mid-America, the Midwest and middle America, they just connect more to someone like Trump versus a progressive East versus East or West Coast elite. And that's the problem. I don't want to digress. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds now, but I think that's the problem with the Democratic Party right now, is there's just too many elites who can't relate to the average person. And that's why someone like Trump has won, is because he appeals more to the average person, because he used language such as "Kamala's stupid," "I'm smart," "I'm the greatest," you know, like, it's this very simple terminology that resonates more with a country that I believe that isn't that educated, versus Kamala, you know, she comes from the elites, and the average person just can't relate to that.
We hear you when we hear you, and we wonder how you would characterize journalism going forward into the future, and thinking about young people considering entering the field of journalism. What would you say to a young person considering that, studying that? Dion, I know you went to college and studied that and came out. How do you feel about that now?
Oh, man, this is I've been asked this before, and this is such a hard question for me to answer, because I love journalism, and people ask me all the time, if I can do anything right now, what would it be? It would be to continue being a journalist. But as someone who comes from a poor economic background, I just cannot get ahead in America on a journalism salary. That's part of the reason why I left and I went into non-journalism, if you will. So I would say, like, if you're prepared to not make much money and you love it enough, do it. But if you come from a middle class family or higher, and your family members can subsidize your cost of living when you're moving around the country for these jobs, then pursue it. But you just have to think, like, what works for you. And after a while, I'm just like, yeah, it's time to make some real money. And I hate to, like, dumb it down to that, because I still freelance, I still write, I still get things published, but to have it be a full-time career, it just, you know, it's, you know, I want to buy a house one day, I want to have a family, you know, I'm just like, I don't think those, it's hard to do those things on a journalism salary. So for me, it's about the love. Don't do it if you don't love it, but I would always encourage people to try it. I don't regret what I've done. I think the 8 years I've been in journalism were like some of the best years of my life, and I don't regret it at all. But I just knew there was a point where like, I got to make a decision if I want to stick with this. And I think for young students who want to pursue this, you have to map out a game plan for yourself, because as much as I loved it, I thought I would never leave it, but you know, that changed. So I would just say, make sure you love it if you want to pursue it. But there's always a way out. And I don't want to make this sound negative. And then she said, there's always a way out and there's always a way in. There's always going to be good journalists needed. And I think there will always be some kind of platform where a journalist can thrive. But just make sure you love it if you want to pursue it.
And maybe somehow the companies who own newspapers and TV stations could begin to think about giving better wages. Let's maybe attack that front, that somebody has to determine these wages. And these people are some of the most deserving in our democracy and in our civilization. And so it seems really wrong that this is the case.
Well, there are two solutions. We're in a capitalistic society, so I don't think there's an incentive to pay journalists more in a for-profit model. The two models that work, and I keep bringing up Germany because I've been there three times to talk about journalism and to talk to journalists there. Their news outlets are primarily public. If I had to guess, more than 75, maybe 80% of the news outlets in Germany are funded with public money. I don't want to bore you, but it's every household in Germany, they're forced to pay a fee for journalism. I don't want to get too far.
This is not boring at all. This is fascinating.
Yeah.
Keep on going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not taxes, but it's a fee that you're required. And to me, and to put it basically, it's essentially a tax, but it's not officially a tax. But and the cost of living, and I know that, you know, you have Paris and you have all these other expensive cities in Europe like London and Berlin, but for the most part, the cost of living in Europe isn't as expensive as it is in America. So there, you don't see journalists losing their jobs because there's a safety net. You know, the cost of living isn't that high. Your salary is guaranteed by households who are forced to pay this fee. That works in Europe. I don't think journalism is suffering in Europe, but it's suffering in the U.S. But I don't think we'll do that. I mean, we have, like, you know, the federal government did fund PBS and NPR, but it only made up a small fraction of their funding. The other portion of the funding relies on donations and by citizens and philanthropists. And that's my second point. That's the second solution. You know, rich philanthropists who value journalism will put their money into like news outlets. The Baltimore Banner, for example, that's a nonprofit news outlet that I think some philanthropist is funding because this person values journalism and they're putting their money to see quality journalism produced. The Marshall Project, for example, they just opened up a site here in St. Louis, and they're funded, I think, with philanthropic and private dollars. And the wages are pretty good. I think one job for an investigative reporter was like six figures. I think I saw when the job was posted a year ago. You know, like, that's the solution, is finding those philanthropic people who are willing to fund journalism, or convincing your government to fund it. I know before I left the CBS affiliate I worked for in St. Louis, I did a story on Illinois, because Illinois is right next door to Missouri. One of the Illinois senators, who's a former news anchor, had proposed like tax credits for small news outlets if they like, you know, kept a certain number of people on staff, you know, things like that. And I think that's the solution. The government partially funding journalism and funding those philanthropic people to fund journalism. I just don't think, as much as we talk about people valuing journalism, you have to pay for, you know, if you value something, you have to pay for it. You know, it takes money to get quality. And I don't think America values journalism that much. I think we value entertainment more than we value being informed. And that's why we see athletes making millions of dollars versus firefighters, police officers, and journalists making pennies. Entertainment is more valuable to us than safety and being informed in America.
And our teachers could use.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. I apologize to the teachers. Exactly.
Well, we agree with your thoughts there that there should be some creative ways to improve the validity of journalism as an occupation, because it's one desperately needed across the world. And it's suffering mm-hmm. everywhere. And you're one proof of the picture that it's difficult to do that kind of work, both while you're doing it and to exist financially. And that's across all the research that I read too. And then there's the disinformation that can occur, though, when certain outlets, certain groups have control of the media. And so the fight to keep journalism open and honest and true is also a fight against disinformation, is it not?
Yes. But social media, right? Like, posts can go viral on social media and get to you faster than your local news outlet. That means a lot of the stuff that we want to correct as journalists, we don't have the power to. We must rely on the federal government and these big media companies to be good faith actors in these spaces, right? When Elon Musk bought Twitter, disinformation and misinformation ran rampant on that site. And the people who own these big companies have to be willing to be good stewards in our society to get rid of that. I remember Facebook had implemented, you know, misinformation and disinformation disclaimers. But then when Trump became president again, Mark Zuckerberg announced that they were going to get rid of those disclaimers. So now it's just like, you want misinformation and disinformation to run rampant again. And when you see something like that as the average person, I think you just have to think you're capitulating to Trump because you want him to help you out so your company can keep making a lot of money.
And I'm reading from the World Press Freedom publication that giants such as Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft have very little dominance over the dissemination of information on their platforms. These largely unregulated platforms are absorbing an ever-growing share of advertising revenues, which of course impacts newspapers, newscasters, and these online platforms further hamper the information space by contributing to the spread of manipulated and misleading content, which amplifies, of course, disinformation.
And we all know this. It appeals to emotions. I mean, when Trump said that Haitians are eating dogs and cats and stuff, it's like,
yes.
That's a lot more sexier to hear that Haitians are filling up our, you know, mm-hmm. Everyone's fighting for attention, and Trump does a really good job of getting people's attention. And if you tell people that immigrants are eating dogs and cats, that will attract a lot more ears and eyeballs and saying, I don't like immigrants coming in this country, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, we're just, and I think this is America, though. Like, we have Hollywood, you know, the world follows Hollywood, you know, when it comes to entertainment. And we're just a society that wants to be entertained. And I think we fall for tricks like that where, you know, there's no credible evidence of Haitians eating dogs and cats. But there's, you know, those news outlets who realize how sexy of a story that is. And then someone can make a false report and say my neighbor is eating a dog or a cat. And that news outlet will find a way to manipulate that to make it really seem like dogs and cats are being eaten. You know why? Because that's sexier than telling the truth. This is why movies do so well, right? Because it's a fictionalized story that you can manipulate to entertain people. And as journalists, we're trying to compete with things like that. People want to be entertained. They don't want to be informed. That's why we work so hard to inform you in an entertaining way.
I know there are several large groups that have bought radio stations, TV stations, newspapers. I'm aware of Adams Group, Sinclair, Gannett. I'm not sure if Pacifica is one of them. Are three of those more conservative?
And that's what I'm trying to figure out is, I do believe part of it is, let's buy this station, let's gut it, make a profit, and then sell it to someone else. But then the fact that they're conservative makes me wonder, are they trying to capitulate to Trump again to try to get more favor with the SEC and the FCC and all these other government organizations that can help facilitate this process? I don't know what I do know the bottom line, the way to make money is to buy it, gut it, make a quick profit, and then flip it. But I think that's the focus of any owner, Republican or conservative or liberal.
Kind of a capitalist.
But I think being conservative helps, though, with the Trump administration.
Again, bottom line, make money, but not particularly care about the quality of what's left.
Yeah. No, exactly.
And, back to the thought of misinformation, the American psychologist last year, actually this year, a worldwide group of psychologists, including people from all around the world and researchers, they said that the claim seen recently that misinformation is not a significant problem is flawed, and that misinformation has impacts on important beliefs and behaviors. Both scholars and policymakers, and I'm going to add their reporters, should therefore continue to take misinformation seriously. So as we're kind of finishing up this talk about journalism, we appreciate that you, Dion, were one of those who would take misinformation seriously and who would work assiduously to present the truth. And we want to thank you for that. And
tell us what you're doing now. You mentioned being more in an administrative position.
Oh, I am currently the Vice President of Communications and Public Affairs for the St. Louis Development Corporation, which is the nonprofit independent arm of the city of St. Louis. We're trying to spur economic development. So I basically handle internal and external communications. I talk with reporters, pitch them stories. They reach out to me for what we're doing, what my organization is doing. Speak on camera, speak to the radio. I'm quoted in newspapers when the CEO and president can't do that. So that's my current role. But like I said, I still dabble in freelance journalism in my free time. I just had a story published in a local newspaper just on Monday about a small German language school in St. Louis County that did pretty well. So I still get a joy out of producing journalism.
And if your first love.
We have about 3 or 4 minutes left in the program. What would you like the Gallatin Valley audience and those who listen on KGVM.org know about this area?
About the area?
Area journalism and keeping it pure.
Oh, man, that's a good question. I would say this would have helped me while I was there. I would say if there's something that you question, don't be afraid to contact the reporter and let them make them aware of a potential issue in your community. And the reporters in Bozeman are normally just out of college, so you might need to do a lot of groundwork for them. And this isn't abnormal, because as a former full-time journalist, people will gather a bunch of data for journalists and provide it to the journalists to make their job easier. And so basically, if you have a situation like that as a citizen that you could, you know, kind of help the journalist figure stuff out, that can really lead to a good story and lead to you seeing an issue resolved. That has helped me out before as a journalist, where, like, I may not be fully aware of a situation, but people would be willing to provide information to me, like information that I can verify that's credible, that can help me tell that story that needs to be told for the greater good of the public.
I really love that concept that we out here, all of the folks, we're not just going to turn this over to reporters, that we could reach out and say, here's this whole aspect of something going on, and we'd like to show you what it is, and here are the facts, and they're verified, or we'll help you verify them, and that we have a role in and a responsibility as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just, I mean, do your homework. I know it sounds so cliche and simple, but, like, do your homework. I even check my own biases sometimes, where, like, I'll see a story and I'll start to form an opinion, and then I'll ask myself, Dion, are there other views for this? Should I be so quick to make a decision about this? And, I mean, this is how news outlets, the ones who aren't being responsible, this is how they manipulate you. You know, and I don't want to use any specific examples, because I don't want to diminish the severity of certain situations, but news outlets will cherry pick data to make you think that something is worse than what it really is. So I would just encourage people to, and I know it takes work and it takes time, but when you being an informed citizen who's voting, you know, you can really make a difference in your community if you take the time to be informed. And it used to be like that, but when you have less, you know, more and more inexperienced reporters reporting in your area, I think that the citizens have to take it upon themselves to do some more research. Even though I know it sucks, but I think that's the reality of the situation that we're in right now.
And I think we each need to be aware that psychologists inform us we have a confirmation bias. What we think we understand, it's hard to let go of. Once an idea has a foot in our door, we want to hang on to it, but we need to be open to be able to change if we need to, and to look at everything, like you said, with a clear eye. Yes.
Yeah, one of my favorite sayings is, a person who's willing to change their opinion is a sign of an open mind.
Okay.
That is a good ending quote to this Health and Happiness program, KGVM 95.9. Thank you, Dion. That was great, and we hope to speak to you again. Thank you, Gallatin Valley.